Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush. It's Chuck Bryant here at our home studio, Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia. And today, we have the great Nate DeMayo to talk about the movie Titanic. And Nate, if you don't know Nate's work, you need to look no further than the amazing, truly amazing podcast, The Memory Palace. It's great. Nate tells stories of history in the way that only Nate DeMayo can do so. I urge you to listen to it. Memory Palace is great. It was one of the first podcasts I started listening to, actually. And he's over there on the Radiotopia Network, and everything they do is awesome. So Nate was kind enough to hit me up because he listened to Movie Crush. And Nate is an old friend, and I was like, dude, you were on my list anyway, so of course we're going to do this together. And a few days later, we were talking to each other about Titanic, obviously the 1997 huge, huge, huge blockbuster movie from James Cameron. Hopefully I don't need to set this one up. Everyone knows this movie, right? This is an interesting one because it's the first one where I sort of had mixed feelings in a way. I did like the movie, but over the years I've come to make fun of it in certain ways for certain things. So it was kind of ended up being a good conversation that Nate and I had. He does not look at it through rose-colored glasses, no pun intended. He sees it for its faults as well. But it was a really great conversation, and I think I got a good fresh perspective myself on this movie. So here we go with Nate DeMayo on Titanic. All right, Nate, let's chat a bit.
Let's do it.
Where are you from? Because I don't even think I know that.
I am from Providence, Rhode Island.
Okay, I did know that. As soon as you said it, I remembered. Because I've been to Rhode Island once to the Newport Folk Fest and sort of fell in love with the state.
Yeah, it's great. It's, you know, the beauty of it in so many ways is that it is kind of off the beaten path. Like, you don't have to drive through it to get from New York to Boston.
Right.
And so it's got, and, you know, it is this little postage stamp. You know, famously, this whole thing is being small, but it is super small. It's like 50 minutes by 45 minutes.
Wow.
But part of the beauty of it is that, because it is just, it was a little bit too far away from Boston to get Boston media back when, you know, you had your broadcast towers and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And so, and so everything, you know, it has its own media, like all the TV and all the radio came right out of Providence.
Uh-huh.
And that signal would then cover the whole state. So it has this weird, like very, very profound sense of itself in this, like, you know, it's unlike, say, living in Delaware, where you get cultural bleed through from Maryland and Pennsylvania and whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Rhode Island is its own thing in a way that very, very few states of its size can kind of possibly say. And that said, it's like a really weird and beautiful thing.
Yeah, I've always had that sense of Delaware, to be honest, not knowing many people from there. But it definitely always struck me as one of the states that, people are from Delaware gonna be so mad. But sort of have been forced to glom on to their surrounding states.
Yeah, I think you have to. I mean, you know, on some level, it's like, you know, you kind of have to jump in on which sports team it's going to be or you know, which, but, you know, and a lot of it just goes down to which, like, broadcast signal you got the most strongly.
Yeah. Isn't that funny how media shapes culture like that?
Totally. Yeah, absolutely.
So what were your early movie going days like?
You know, I think about this a lot. My dad was a pretty cool dad. You know, he was a college professor. He taught, like, my mom. They met at Rhode Island College and they taught at Rhode Island College and they both taught special ed.
That's
like they
awesome.
Would teach people to be special ed teachers.
Uh-huh.
But my dad was like really kind of a cultural hipster. And so, you know, he had great music and he like read a lot of comic books and that were in all these great books that were on his shelf, like when I was ready to go in and find them. And so he like kind of led me down a pretty cool movie path. So I spent a lot of time, like, for sure, you know, going to see the blockbusters for sure. But also we spent a bunch of time at the Avon, which was our, you know, indie movie theater.
Right.
You know, right near the Brown campus. You know, cause Providence has that nice thing of both being, you know, having cultural stuff cause Brown and RISD are there, but also being kind of like a classic blue collar New England town.
Right.
But we spent a lot of time at the Avon, you know, like I would see, we'd see the kids movies. So like, this was like Snoopy Come Home and stuff. But, one of the most sort of profound movie going experiences when I was a little kid, was seeing Ralph Bakshi's Wizards. Did you ever see that?
What was it called?
It's called Wizards.
I think I know that movie.
It's so good. I mean, you know, it's this sort of like, you know, cartoon for grown-ups that wasn't like as adult as like Fritz the Cat or whatever. So I could like, it was more or less age appropriate when I was like 6 or 7. Like it's probably for, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
Right.
And it's just this sort of like, you know, kind of like violent sort of fantasy epic, that just blew me away, this animated movie. And, we would, you know, this was back in the slightly pre, just before the ubiquity of video recorders. And so we would, they would just run this movie sometimes in a weekend, and I would see it every time. You know, I'd see it like, I probably saw it 13 times at the Avon Cinema over the course of like 10 years.
I totally know this
and,
movie.
Yeah.
I know exactly which one. That poster with the guy, the creepy.
The guy
looking
in red sitting on the weird two-legged, like horse.
Yep.
Yeah, and it's set in a world in which there are wizards and stuff, but there's also just like military technology.
Uh-huh.
as a kid, it was amazing. Like it sort of tickled every you know, kind of nerd bone that I had.
Right.
And I would grow up, you know, really, really loving movies, you know, just like absolutely, it was a huge part of our sort of family life. It was a huge sort of vision of what, you know, I like thought like might be possible in the world is, you know, to make movies, to like be in Hollywood or something like that was sort of an early dream, early on. And, you know, I was a kid who like, you know, I would, when I got a little bit older, like I would read Premiere Magazine all the time.
Oh, same here.
But yeah, we spent a lot of time at the Avon. This is like the time of like, you know, going to see like Local Hero or the Merchant Ivory movies or like, you know, Henry V when I was like in, you know, eighth grade or something like that, right. The Kenneth Branagh version. And, you know, and then at home when we got our VCR, we would go rent them at this electronics store, and they had this rental place at the back of the electronics store, and they're very limited. They had a very limited thing, but like my dad like pretty aggressively curated what we saw.
Yeah.
You know, like we could say, oh shoot, I want to see E.T. again. And that was great. Like he had no problem with that, but he was kind of like, you know what? If we're going to have to, we're going to all watch this movie and this is the thing we're doing tonight. Well, let's make it be sort of good. And so,
yeah,
you know, like that's how I saw all the Hitchcock movies, you know,
right.
It would just be like, oh, which one are they? Oh, look, you know, Rope is here. I guess we're seeing Rope tonight. And yeah, like I definitely kind of grew up, with movies being a big part of my life. But also, you know, kind of like doing a lot of, kind of like virtue signaling through movie choices, you know, like I was definitely, you know, kind of, training to be sort of like an aesthete and uh-huh. kind of like, you know, I easily could have been like kind of like a pompous little shit if it weren't for the fact that like, I feel like my dad was just so like, so kind of open-hearted about it. Like he just wanted to find something great and beautiful. So there's a little bit of like, you should see this movie, it's cool, but it was mostly like, oh, you should see this movie, it's so cool.
Right.
Which is an important distinction, an important sort of, you know, trick to learn as a kid.
Yeah, man, I always get so jealous when I hear about people that had these, not to knock my parents too much, but I guess I'm knocking my parents a little bit, but they just, I don't know, culture like music and movies weren't that big of a thing for them. And I think I've said on another episode, I think the last movie my father saw in the theater was Bo Derek's Tarzan the Ape Man movie in whatever, the early 80s. It just wasn't a thing. My mom would occasionally, we have the big Fox Theater here in Atlanta, which is our big grand old Egyptian style concert venue, but they had movie nights. And so when I was a kid, she did occasionally, like she took me to see Rear Window and Gone with the Wind, I think, and like maybe another couple of movies at the Fox when they would run movies. So that was kind of cool, but neither one of them had just seemed to care about like, hey, this is culture and these are the kind of things you should watch. I was on my own. Thank God I had an older brother who was into it. Cause
well, that's, yeah, exactly. I mean, you would have found it anyway. Yeah.
Well, for sure.
I don't know. Like, there was also just something to me about, You know, living sort of in, like, we lived in Providence when I was a kid, and then we moved right, like, 15 minutes away, right across the border to Rehoboth, Massachusetts, when I was a little bit older. And, you know, I would go into town, you know, like, just prior, just, like, right at the cusp of teenagehood. And, you know, because it was all sort of in the Brown campus and, like, or near the Brown campus, and all the sort of, like, cute RISD girls are walking around, there was just something about going to the movies that just seemed like adulthood to me. Like,
right.
I was so psyched to do that, and so psyched to be, like, making those choices. And there was, like, also, like, a whole set of movies that, like, I, you know, there was this indie movie I've never seen to this day, but my parents went to go see this movie called Eating Raoul.
Oh, yeah, I remember
which
that.
Which is some... Yeah, so it's some sort of like transgressive comedy from the mid-80s or whatever. And I like they would just like talk about it among, you know, with their, you know, adult friends, like just laughing their asses off. And I had no idea what the movie was about, you know, but I knew it was something that was not for me. And there was something so exciting about like, oh, someday I'm going to get to do that. And there was also this other movie theater called The Cable Car in Providence that's still there, which was another kind of art house movie theater and repertory theater. And it had couches, you know, and like you'd sit and you can kind of eat, and they'd have like kind of beat up old, you know, kind of Fleabag love seats. And the idea of like going on a date, you know, with some girl and going to the cable car was like a dream that I could not wait to fulfill.
So you started doing that like in high school?
Yeah, totally. You know, and then it, like one of the nice things about living, you know, in this little, you know, my town was this kind of rural town, but then it really was just 15 minutes out of the city. And so there, I had this fun thing, but when I could first drive, because my, you know, because my folks were from Providence, because they lived in Providence as a kid, and also because my dad, we would go to the Avon movie theater, we would go to the cable car, and he would take me to record stores too, and the comic book stores. I just like knew the city, like I you know, knew Providence. And so when I first got my license, like I ended up becoming this sort of like, you know, tour guide, for the other kids in my town who kind of like, you know, they were the Truck Bryants in my town. They hadn't seen that much.
Yeah.
They hadn't seen the movies. And so I'd be like, oh, we can go see this movie. And they're like, oh, we can? I'm like, yeah, totally. Hop in the car. I literally know the place, the weird place that you can park and not have to pay at the meter.
You're like, you guys like haven't seen Eating Raoul?
You haven't seen Eating Raoul? It's fabulous. I saw it when I was five.
That's pretty funny. Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Geez, my dad never took me to a record store, to a comic book store.
But you turned out fine, Chuck.
I know. Thank God for my brother, like I said. But I was definitely the kid that subscribed to Premiere Magazine. And I remember, how old are you? You're about my age, right?
43.
Okay, 46 here. So I remember when... And this is kind of silly looking back, but I remember when Entertainment Tonight debuted. And what a big deal that was. I was like, I have this show I can watch every night that talks about Hollywood and the movies. And it seemed, especially being in Atlanta, so far away that I didn't even know you could work in movies. I didn't know that was an option in life.
I'm in the same boat. Obviously I knew it was like a job, but I feel like I spent, I don't think until I was 22 that I, or so, did I understand that the people who did things that were, that I thought were cool, like make movies and write books and, and whatever. Like, I don't think I understood that they were real people. Like, I didn't know that they're, like, on some, like, existential level, I didn't understand that, that the people who I sort of, like, admired, like, had just sort of, like, regular lives that led them to that point.
Yeah, for sure.
You know? It seemed so, you know, just seems so far away.
Yeah. I've talked to friends that, have like started working in the film industry out of high school. And I always think, man, what, I didn't know that was an option. And what a leg up you have. You know, college is great and everything, but if you start working on a film crew when you're 19, like by the time you're 30, you're shooting a movie if that's what you want to do, you know?
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Like I ended up going to college out in California for a number of reasons, but it mostly had to do with we could afford a state school and I wanted to get out of town. And I ended up going to UC Santa Barbara in part because I thought that I wanted to make movies. And when I got there and started to take a couple of film classes, it was just so intimidating because all these kids were these Southern California kids and who just like, who like fundamentally knew what they wanted to do, like knew what all the jobs were, all like knew what all the jobs were on the, you know, call sheet, you know, knew all that stuff. And I found it totally freaked me out. Like it totally, yeah, you know, instead of it being this like, oh, look, here I am, this is something that I can do, like this guy knows, you know, it cowed me. It took me like a long time to kind of like, you know, realize that there were other ways to create. And if I did want to get into the movie or TV business or whatever, that there were other avenues. Like you didn't have to be someone's kid.
Right.
Which so often was the case out in Santa Barbara.
Oh, for sure. Well, and then you ended up writing some for TV, right?
Yeah. No, I did, you know, and when I moved out here to LA, which is at this point is about 15 years ago or so, you know, I was in a long distance relationship with my wife, Lila Gerstein, who is a TV writer. And, you know, there was like when I met her in New York and she was like, had just moved out to try to write TV, like there was something so like I was intoxicated by the boldness of that. Like the idea that someone could like even think to do that was amazing to me. You know, and then I got out here and then the truth of the matter is one of the things that's nice to be, you know, as a, you know, even though I work in radio and to be like a creative person in Hollywood, like eventually Hollywood intersects with whatever you're creating in some way. You know, if you're in a band, then you happen to like write the theme song for some show that doesn't, you know, go or, you know, so then for me, it was that, you know, Mike Shore from, Parks and Rec and The Good Place is a friend of mine. And he asked me to, he likes the podcast and, you know, my podcast, The Memory Palace, which is this historical podcast. He ends up wanting, you know, he and Greg Daniels, the creator of Parks and Rec, are thinking about doing one of those Arcadia Press books, which is that company that puts out one of those sepia tone photo books for every town in America, essentially. You know, every neighborhood has one of these. And they thought they'd do like a fake one for Pawnee, the fictional town in Parks and Recreation. And so then, you know, I ended up like co-writing a book with Mike and then writing an episode of Parks. And then again, a couple of years later, because of the podcast, being asked to write for a ABC miniseries about the space program. And, you know, and that's these kind of like Hollywood things that come to you when you literally live in Hollywood like I do.
Well, I own that book, so because of you.
Oh, thank you.
Of course.
Oh, good.
So before we get to Titanic.
Sure.
And all that entails, I do want to hear a little bit because when I threw it out to you about, you texted me or emailed me and said, I love Movie Crush. And I was like, well, dude, you're on the list. So let's do this. And here we are like 4 days later doing it. But, you said, you know, I have a few picks and I found that to be the case with a lot of guests is it's tough to land on that favorite movie for most people. Some people know it automatically, but most people are like, you know, on any given day, it could be a number of movies. So like, maybe which one do you want to talk about? And I didn't hear any of your other picks. I just sort of forced your hand, but I would like to hear some of the other ones
that
you were debating.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that one of the things about movies in me, I think this is a little bit true of books as well, is that, so often it really just has to do with the time in my life, you know? There's a movie that just like comes into your life, like at exactly the right time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it will hold up or it won't hold up, but like, you're never going to give that away. And so like, I have movies like that. Like that movie Wizards, like hands down was my favorite movie, you know, for the first 12 years of my life.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you know, and then there was a phase, you know, in which Harold and Maude was my favorite movie, you know, and Do the Right Thing was my favorite movie.
So great.
You know, and Red by Krzysztof Kieslowski, like blew my mind at one point. And now I can barely remember what it's about.
Right.
But I would have totally like stood by it, you know, forever. And so I don't know, like there was like a number of things that I, you know, and then there's, you know, there are like certain movies that like, you know, I don't know that I can defend them. So well, but God, do I love them. And, I don't know. I was trying to think of what would be a fun movie to talk about. But like, before we get into why it's good, like Titanic, I feel like is actually kind of formative for me in a weird way. Like, I think that like, you know, coming out of being sort of introduced to like the kind of like aesthetic possibilities of sort of underground tastes as like as a young kid, you know, I really went down that road. Like I was like a super hipster, you know,
before
for many years of my life.
They were called hipsters.
Yeah, totally. Like I just like, you know, it was just particularly once I hit college, you know, I was like deep underground, particularly in terms of music, but in books and movies and all sorts of stuff. And that was, you know, was and is like a big sort of part of my life. But there was this like stretch where like, and it's really in the late 90s, like right around the time that Titanic comes out, when there were like a bunch of things that kind of were out there. Like particularly, like I remember hearing songs on the radio, like there's a couple of like Destiny's Child, hits that came out.
Yeah.
And I remember like going to see, you know, some like super, you know, super out there band, like something like, I feel like I went to go see like U.S. Maple or you know, one of these just like, you know, super angular, no reason anyone would actually, you know, sort of borderline unlistenable bands that I happened to find interesting and beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, but then like listening on the radio and like hearing some like, you know, hearing some like Timbaland production and being like, holy shit, this is like as progressive
right.
and as like almost like transgressive as like anything that I'm going to see.
Yeah.
And there's just, you know, and just like there was something about, a bunch of the kind of like pop music that came out, during the late 90s, particularly in like the R&B side. That mm-hmm. I was like, you know what, like, you know, I would love to, you know, like it really is time, at least personally, to like, you know, there should be no room in my life, like to be, you know, kind of a snob about this stuff. Like, let's just like find beautiful things, like find things that move you and find things that are new and exciting. And like, and sometimes that like totally comes in the mainstream, and Titanic was 100% one of those things. Like it was like a formative thing to like, you know, to see something, you know, probably in a week in which like I had also rented like 2 Gregor Rocky movies or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
You know, to go to the theater and just be like, movies, man, this is what it's all about. Even though, of course, like I spent a lot of time with the other things that movies are about and these like, you know, art, you know, sort of aesthetic innovations and these like, you know, small movies that just like, you know, move you so deeply. I then went to like Titanic and I was like, good God, like nothing in the world can sweep you away and like engulf you. And, you know, like a big, beautiful mainstream movie like Titanic.
Yeah. I know what you mean. It's a very liberating feeling when you reach the age where you don't give a shit about being cool for being cool's sake or impressing anyone with how deep your tastes go and how obscure the bands are that you like. And just saying, yeah, I might go and see, Silver Jews on a Tuesday night. And then the next day, I think, Don't Go Chasing Waterfalls is like the best song of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I know. And it's like, whatever. It's like, you know, it's the most obvious thing. And I think in a lot of ways also, I think like our cultural moment right now is built on that knowledge, you know? Like I think, you know, when you have like a Pitchfork, you know, reviewing a Taylor Swift album, you know, and giving it whatever 7.8 on the same day that you review like the world's most obscure, you know, German proto techno reissue.
Yeah.
And giving it the same ranking, you know, like that is where we're at. And but at the same time, it's a liberating and kind of like beautiful place to be. And it's also, it's fundamentally like where I've been at since around the time of Titanic. I have no doubt that evil villain James Cameron has something to do with it.
All right. Well, let's talk about Titanic because this is the first one of the interviews that I've done where I sort of had some problems with the movie.
Sure.
But having said that, yeah, no, that is good because I knew I was going to have to cross this bridge and I want to cross it with you, Nate. Having said that, I've seen the movie. I've probably seen Titanic 10 times.
Right, absolutely.
And I saw it in the theater, and it was one of those where when I saw it in the theater with my sister in Arizona, because I lived with them for 9 months, my sister and her husband and their 2 little girls, I was moved to tears and thought, man, that's one of the great movies ever made.
Yeah.
And with time, sadly, I've come to pick it apart a little bit which I will do, and we can get into a little bit, but tell me about your first experience with it.
My first experience with it was, I saw it, there was a set of movie theaters, near where my parents lived in Rehoboth, in this town, which I didn't even realize it, but I've now since to come realize is hilariously named Seekonk. And so Seekonk, Mass was the town next door, and they had a couple of movie theaters, and they had like a Chili's and stuff. So this was the big time.
Yeah.
And, so they built right in like 96, 97, they built a stadium seating thing, which blew my mind at this, you know, they had sort of like an annex to their original showcase movie theaters, and we called it Newconk. And so this is one of the first times I went to Newconk, and they, and saw Titanic with a few friends. And it was very much like supposed to be kind of like a lark, you know, like, oh, might have even been opening weekend. Like, oh, let's go see the big blockbuster. I'm sure it's going to be kind of like goofy and delicious. And let's go do that. And also, Titanic was totally one of those things that if you were a reader of Premiere Magazine or like at all, like the entertainment press, this movie is supposed to be terrible. You know, like everything about it was this, like the whole thing is like, there's these like epic stories about like what a boondoggle this was and like what a disastrous thing. And, you know, and I had also seen, The Abyss, and The Abyss is almost a perfect movie. And then at the end, it is so bad.
Yeah.
How do you feel about The Abyss?
I love The Abyss I'm just like you. I thought The Abyss was really great. And, at the end, it kind of fell apart, and sort of also James Cameron, which some of my nitpicks with Titanic, like he bugs me a bit as a screenwriter more so than a director.
Yes. And yeah. And I feel like you see some of that stuff on The Abyss in particular. It's like he's created this perfectly moving machine for so long. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, like, I think in his heart of hearts and like the things that he care about are pretty dippy, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I just think like his ideas about the magic of the world, like, do not like align with mine.
Yeah,
I think part of the success of Titanic is that he doesn't have like that. It's not about imagination. You know, I think that the fact that he's able to do these like big grand storytelling swings and in this sort of like, you know, epic, you know, this kind of epic sweeping romance and all these like, you know, ridiculous slash, you know, really functional and really beautiful, you know, stereotypical character types and all this stuff that is so, you know, classic, that gets embedded into these movies.
Yeah.
You know, he's not left to also imagine some really dumbass world,
right?
You know, yeah, that articulates like some principles about, you know, about whatever his dream for humanity or whatever.
So you're in this theater, like me, you knew
about
the $200 million budget and what a disaster. Sort of a process that it was, and you're with your friends, and what happens?
I cry a lot.
Okay.
You know, like, I really cry. I really just cry a lot. And I think that, like, you know, with my podcast, like, you know, so much of what I do is talk about, you know, there's kind of like real moments in history and kind of like remind people of what the real experiences, you know, of events like the Titanic sinking, you know, to a certain degree. Are. And so on the one hand, it's just like, with his ability to, you know, put like the same stuff that he'd applied to like design crazy space, underwater vessels and have monsters attack them and all that shit.
Yeah.
Like to put that energy into making the Titanic feel like this, like, you know, living, breathing organism with, where there are people, you know, who we've been introduced to, and to watch them meet their watery, you know, go to a watery grave. I found it incredibly moving. Like I had this visceral sense of like, oh, holy shit, this was real. Holy shit. Like, you know, what an ordeal, you know, all the stuff that's, you know, all this sort of top level stuff I found super moving. You know, I don't know that I bought into or cared that much about the love story. And, but that said, you know, I also think it's sort of like, perfectly done. Even though I might have personally recast the movie like 17 different ways before I came down to, you know, this particular combination of people. I also know that it's exactly right for what it should be. So I saw it once. And like loved it. And I feel like I had a couple hipster friends with me who were not entirely on board.
Yeah.
And then some months later, I was on a date with this, hardcore girl. Like she was the super punk rock girl named Erin. And I was like, you know what? We're going to go see Titanic. She's like, no, we're not going to see that trash. And like she was a sobbing mess and it really worked out. The whole thing worked out really well.
So she had not seen it yet.
She had not seen it. She was like, no, screw that, man. I'm not gonna see that trash. Give me a Greg Araki movie.
Right.
but she was swept away.
Yeah, Titanic was one of those too that it had been a long time since a movie came along that ran for that long. It ran for 10 months in the theater. And
yeah.
I remember when we were kids, that kind of thing used to happen, and they used to advertise like, you know, 37th week on screen and stuff like that. But that kind of went the way of the dodo until Titanic came along, I feel like.
Yeah, totally. And so, like, you know, the gap between me going with my friends the first time and the gap, you know, and then seeing it again with Punk Rock Erin, I think, like, it might have been, like, 10 months. It might have been 11 months.
Yeah.
It was still in the theater. And there were, you know, and we went and there was a group of girls, like a group of, like, young teenage girls who had clearly, you know, seen it 7 times, who were, quoting lines and stuff. And if it weren't for the like power of the kind of like the, you know, the movie to, you know, kind of shut them up on some level, like they would have driven us crazy because they started the movie like, okay, I'm going to quote every Fabrizio line.
You know? Right.
Like, but pretty soon into it, like they're just wrapped up just again for what literally has probably, you know, could have been their 15th showing, you know, 15th time to the movies to see, you know, to see Dreamboat, on the Dreamboat. it's a fairly remarkable thing, but no, like I've since seen it, you know, multiple times. You know, it's definitely a movie that I will watch a chunk of every time it's on.
Yeah. Same here.
And I find different things in it, each time. Like I remember, one time, like watching it, like starting it way too late, like hanging out with friends, being sort of inebriated, starting it like, you know, 12:30 at night and be like, we're really going to do this? We're really going to, like, you know, almost get to dawn watching this movie.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, not only did it drag me through and never put me to sleep, like, you know, and I just remember having this like profound love for the fakeness of it all. Like I just was so clued into the sets and so clued into like the heavy pancake makeup. And just like so aware of that someone had spent all of this money to put on a show for us.
Yeah.
And, you know, that like it is amazing to think that all of that money, which shouldn't be spent on anything besides like feeding and clothing people, yet somehow, you know, in this 3-hour chunk watching this, you know, grand spectacle, was just so beautiful. Like the work of it all in that particular showing, I found amazing. And then a few years ago, they did that re-release in 3D. And my wife and I went. Did you happen to see the 3D release? Did you go to that?
No, I'm not a big 3D fan, but I do remember that like 4 or 5 years ago.
Made another big chunk of money. But the beauty of it was it turned out the 3D was incredibly well suited to it. There were just all of these things that over and over and over again, you know, like, you know, Jack and Rose are, you know, neck deep, and the volume of the water, like the dimensionality of the water, was really powerful. And then it also all like you really got this sort of claustrophobia of the spaces and all this stuff. It was totally killer. And so, you know, over and over and over again, I see it and my admiration, you know, of it, grows deeper, even though like you, I'm sure I can tick off, you know, a long list of things that are just, ridiculous about this movie, like completely ridiculous. Yeah. I don't want anyone to be confused. There is nothing like when I say that I love Titanic, that it might as well be my favorite movie. None of it is because like it's so bad it's good. Like, right. I deeply stand for this movie, and over and over and over again, I find its flaws only merely like truly enhance it.
Yeah, I mean, it won.
So what?
How many Academy?
So pick it apart.
11 Academy Awards.
I think so. And why not? You know, the guy's the king of the world. Why not?
Yeah, it broke records and tied records for Academy Award nomination. So it's not like anyone can say this movie is so bad it's good.
No, absolutely.
Before I pick it apart, I do want to say that I was on board with the love story. I will just go ahead and say that. I thought that was a very smart approach to telling the story. And he pitched it as Romeo and Juliet on the Titanic. And I just thought that was a really very practical, smart way to go about telling the story of the Titanic.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it's interesting too, cause like in some ways, like it's almost the only way you can tell the story.
Yeah.
But it's essentially perfectly done. Their love is so clear, you know, like uh-huh. the upstairs down, like the literal upstairs downstairs of it all.
Right.
Is so perfectly designed, you know, I mean, like, you know, there's just this, the fact that it is so deeply kind of embedded in class in a way that isn't just bullshit. It isn't just like she's the, you know, he's the poor kid. She's the rich girl. Can they find love? Like class, right. like really is like, you know, for all of the ludicrous ways in which it gets expressed, you know, so, you know, he goes upstairs and he has this, you know, he's been invited, you know, to this dinner by Cal, by Billy Zane, you know, for saving Rose's life, supposedly.
Yeah.
You know, but there's also like the class thing of like, of course the guy in steerage is going to be spotted by like the stewards, and they're going to assume that he is, you know, trying to rape and murder, you
right.
know, the upper class lady. Like, like that stuff feels both very pointed and very real. And it's got this like ridiculous stuff. Like I love the dance sequence downstairs,
uh-huh.
But it's also the most absurd thing. Like, look at these people down in steerage. Like, aren't they so much more joyful? Don't they know how to live the poor? Like, all that stuff, is so absurd, but works so well. And over and over and over again, he doesn't miss, like, you know, Cameron as a writer, like, doesn't miss, like, a moment to tell you exactly where, what the moral universe of this movie is, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Jack is going to open up something in Rose that Rose truly needs. And that is uh-huh. like valid and pure and beautiful. And if she doesn't, she is going to, by the time, if he doesn't fix this thing, by the time the boat lands in New York, you know, she is going to marry this guy who over and over and over again proves to be a true, true villain. And he is a villain, because he is rich. It's not just, he is not just a rich villain. Like it is his richness. And his privilege that it like is his villainy. And it is Jack's like opposite. And it's because Jack is the opposite. That is where his virtue lies. And, you know, it's a complete moral universe, and it sets up this romance that is like so good. And also like their meet cute is like fundamentally epic. Like it is so good.
Yeah.
When, you know, it's got all the good romantic comedy things, it's got all the good classic romance stuff. And the idea that Cameron has like laid this out, to time out perfectly for, to like, you know, tell this nerd's history of the Titanic in this evening.
Yeah.
Is just totally chef's kiss stuff. It's great.
Yeah. So here's my thing. It is so shitty to years later to make fun of the very non-cynical, kind of pure-hearted vision that James Cameron had for this. He never said, I'm going to make an art house film about the Titanic. He was like, I'm going to make sort of it's his big dopey take on these very obvious, like you were saying, class themes, but he never pretended it was going to be anything else. I think he wanted to make a movie that 13-year-old girls could just totally understand, and watch. I don't know if he intended on them to watch it 12 times. I'm sure he'd love that aspect of it, but, he never pretended it was anything else. So it's kind of a shitty thing to go back and say, oh, well, James Cameron's just so obvious about, you know, the way he tells a story. Like that's the movie he wanted to make.
Oh, absolutely. And what a good movie to want to make, frankly. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know, like when I watch, I mean, you and Hodgman talked about Avengers, like when I watch movies like that, like you can just like, you can feel the sort of corporate calculation like over and over and over again.
Absolutely.
And like, I have no doubt that Cameron, you know, wanted to make a huge blockbuster. And I have no doubt that the studio was licking their chops, you know, waiting for the four quadrant, whatever, you know, to kick in and count their billions or whatever. But like, he really, like, he wanted to make a throwback movie in like the best possible sense. Like this, he wanted to make like an epic romance, totally succeeded. He wanted to make, you know, grand spectacle, totally succeeded. And the thing that's kind of amazing when you talk about like, this isn't the art house version of Titanic.
Right.
I'm not sure that the art house version of Titanic, which I would like to see, I don't know that the art house version of Titanic, like, would nail moments like the old lady and the old man,
man,
lying down in their bed while their water dries. Like, I don't know that they can, that the things that one could get metaphorically out of a night on the Titanic.
Yeah.
You know, whether they are about class or whether they are about suffering or whatever sort of highfalutin ideas, that the art house version, I don't know, like, he has found a way to also do those things in this same movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't leave, like, he's got the scape, he's got the size, he's got the length to find a way to, like, infuse that in you. Like, I'm not sure what else was, like, I don't know what, like, Truffaut, you know, would have been able to, like, wring out of, like, this idea, that Cameron didn't find a way to, like, to kind of have his cake and eat it too about.
Yeah. And here's the thing, too. I think he told the love story well enough to where, I don't know if you remember this, but when I was watching the movie, there are moments that I forgot they were on the Titanic.
Yeah.
Even though Cameron, like, one of my beefs is he's so sort of ham-fisted with a lot of his script.
Sure.
That he's constantly sort of throwing in these cutesy lines about, like, one of the things that always bugged me and still does is the line, actually a lot of the Billy Zane stuff bugged me because it's Billy Zane.
Sure.
But when he said, yeah,
the Phantom, not the Shadow.
When he said something about, was it Picasso's that he had?
Oh yeah. And Monet's. Oh God. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Like, oh, they'll never be worth a thing. And it's just, I could see James Cameron just typing that and thinking how clever that is. And I want to punch him in the face, but I had to just throw that stuff out and ignore it and remember that I'm watching this good love story. And I forget that they're on the Titanic until that moment hits where the iceberg comes. And then I remember literally being kind of shocked back into like, holy shit, this thing is going to sink.
No, every time I've seen the movie, you know, whatever it is, like six or seven times, every single time I see the movie, when the iceberg comes, it's really like that moment that happens like when they're back on deck.
Yeah.
Where they're being chased by Billy Zane and Lovejoy is his name, his valet.
Yeah,
his
David
valet,
Warner.
You know? Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. Where they're being chased down and like the whole thing with the planted heart of the sea, all that stuff's about to go down. And they're about to be caught. There's that moment where, oh, that's right. The Titanic still has to sink and we have so much movie left, you know, left to go. Like, there's this thing like, oh, my God, that's right. That's actually what this movie's supposed to be about. And it's that thing about you forget that it's taking place in the Titanic. And it's interesting that that isn't a flaw, you know? Like, it's interesting that, like, that he really essentially has more or less completed a certain part of the movie. And when, like, the Titanic is about to sink, it's like, it's a phenomenal thing to think that there's like an hour and 10 minutes of like spectacle, like on a grand stage that like, I'm not sure we've seen since.
Yeah.
Never mind, like seen before. And there's like so many sort of emotional moments still to come. There's so much sort of spectacle, like all of that money is about to like, you know, pop up on the screen. It's really incredible, that he's able to pull that off. And I kind of fall for it every single time. You know, like my biggest, the goofiest thing in this movie to me, is the frame story. The goofiest thing is the old lady, the bookend stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's the old lady. You know, it's the James Cameron-ness of it, you know, like that thing of James Cameron Sea Explorer, like the times in which James Cameron sort of like really kind of inserts himself, you know, in the guise of the late Bill Paxton.
Yeah.
is amazing. And one of the other things that like that just kills me to know about this movie is that James Cameron himself drew the drawings.
Yeah.
Which I find so absurd, because the first of all, the drawings are one of the only times that they feel like things feel really anachronistic. There's something so sort of contemporary. Uh-huh. They look like what a director in 1997, like that his idea of drawing. And all of the drawing stuff is so dumb. But that thing that you were saying about like that Billy Zane's lines, you know, are so villainous. But it really, like, they all really add up to this, like, such clarity in terms of, like, who the villains are, what we're looking for, you know, like, the idea that this is, it's like, it is a 12-year-old girl's idea or a 12-year-old boy's idea of, like, what art and love are supposed to be.
Yeah.
But those things are still so sort of, like, mythically powerful, you know? So, you know, not only is Jack, you know, like this kind of handsome rogue and this kind of like vagabond, he like ticks all the boxes. Like he won his ticket, you know, by being clever at cards.
Right.
You know, he's like, he's always up for an adventure. He's from Chippewa Falls, but here he is, you know, having dinner with John Jacob Astor. You know,
right.
he's also like somehow a bohemian artist as well. You know, it's like, if only he had a motorcycle, he would have like clicked like all the rebel boxes.
You got to give Cameron credit. Like, he really went for it, at least. He's like, man, if I'm going to throw some tropes people's way and some classic themes, I'm going to, like, spoon it on.
No, and the other thing that he can do that I just thought about this now, the other thing that he can do that girls from 11 to 14 really, really want in their boys is he can dance.
Yeah.
You know, like he is also Patrick Swayze. Not only is he James Dean, not only is he Harrison Ford on some level, he is also Patrick Swayze. You know, it's like, it's hilarious. I mean, it's one thing that they go down and they like, you know, do the reel and, you know, he holds her close and all those like magical things about dancing that literally anyone can do if you just like, you know, aren't such an uptight asshole, you know, like just throw yourself into it and dance like you mean it and you can do those things.
Right.
He also has his moment when he's like the master of the Irish jig, which is hilarious. Yeah. He's also the master of he's mastered the Irish jig. And then immediately she goes on point because, you know, she is, you know, staid and, you know, has been everything she's learned has been through like been through school and informal things. But here's Jack, this, you know, all id, character. But the dude can dance. Like he like Travolta before him, like Swayze before him. He's got it all.
Well, the only thing they didn't do, and I bet you this is a deleted scene, is sneak into the kitchen and he prepares her like a 4-star chef quality meal.
It's really true. Like he learned it like riding the rails.
Let's talk about the sinking, because just still expertly executed, chilling great hour plus, I don't know how long, what hour and 10 or 12 minutes of the ship sinking that was just so well done.
Oh, it's amazing. You know, but I think that the thing that one of the things I really admire from like a storytelling point of view is that in the scene after, you know, basically Jack, you know, steals Rose away from the formal dinner.
Yeah.
You know, she goes off to like walk him and like apologize for how snooty and hoity-toity everyone was and what a dick, you know, her fiance is. Mm-hmm. And he's like, he blows it off. He's like, come dancing with me. And they go dancing. And then Lovejoy spots them. And then there's a little chase and they do the drawing and all that stuff. Between those scenes and then the scenes in which Lovejoy is chasing them and they're kind of gleefully running away from him. Not quite knowing that the Titanic's about to sink and, that, you know, he's about to catch them and the stone has been planted and all that stuff. In those sets of scenes, they run the whole ship. Like we see every single place that is important to understand what is about to happen. Like Like, you know, these are the holds that if these things fill up, we will sink. Like, this is the engine that if this thing fails, we will, you know, we will not be able to push on.
Oh.
And all of those sequences, all of the places that we see, we are about to see again. Like, we're about to see them again, either in montage where, like, the engine guys are like, you know, oh, we're giving her all she's got, Captain, kind of thing, mm-hmm. or they're about to drown. Like, we're all of those places that will dictate how we experience the sinking of the Titanic. We have masterfully been to all of those places, and we've seen them in like a more joyful light, which I think is kind of important.
Yeah.
And also, you know, and we've happened in this like whirlwind of they're running around and they're like whirlwind sort of like romance. We've just met these people whose characters are very, like, they're not like particularly well sketched out, you know. There's like Tommy, the guy who's playing like the flute or whatever.
Right.
And then there's like the little girl who, Jack says, you're still my special girl, Flora, whatever her name is.
Yeah.
You know, we've connected with the people, you know, down below. Mm-hmm. We've seen the spaces that we need to understand, you know, to understand exactly what's going to happen, and B, we get the layout and we understand the mechanism, but we're going to see those things, not only sort of meet their doom, in just a few minutes, like Jack and Rose are going to have to like go back through them. Like they're going to have to like swim their way through these things.
Yeah.
And it's really masterful. Like the first 2 hours in so many ways, you know, in all that stuff, in the telling of their love story, Cameron gives us all the information that we need to fully experience the like heartbreak and also just the kind of like film majesty of the last hour.
Yeah.
And it like kills me. It's so well done.
Totally. Totally. And I remember the big shot for me, man, was at the end when they have climbed all the way up to the now vertical stern of the ship, and that great shot, man, where the camera comes over and he goes, and, you know, it was a little ham-fisted that he set it up in the bookend exactly how the Titanic would sink. But
right.
I give it to him. It was helpful for people to have that understanding.
Totally.
'Cause to know that at the end when they get up there and they're on the rear of the ship that is now completely upright, and he said, this is it, and you know it's going to go down in like 30 seconds or something. It's
right.
Truly like I'm getting a little chill now. I remember being in the theater, and it was just devastating and scary as hell.
And just like, it's so, you know, as ham-fested as it is, it's like, it's entirely necessary. Like, what a perfect piece of exposition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've forgotten that you received it as exposition, you know.
Sure.
It's now hours. It's now like literally, it's literally hours later.
Yeah.
You know, there it is. It's come back and you remember it and you know it's about to happen. That sense of impending doom is there. And also through that whole sequence, there are just these like fairly indelible shots. There's the one where it starts to pitch and then all the people are trying to like, you know, hang on and, you know, some of the kind of shittily CGI people start to like, you know, bang away.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, yeah, but the terror of it is like so real. And also the fact that, it's been such a noisy movie. And there's been so much sort of score and there's been so much, you know, diegetic music and all that stuff that, it's super silent up top.
Yeah.
You know, almost every time they go up top, like, there's very little music playing and mm-hmm. it's just chilling, you know, and then they set up there's the stuff about the, like, there are all these like little, at this point, kind of like iconic moments, that are kind of goofy, but they really work. The thing with the band playing on deck.
Yeah.
Is really something.
I know,
you know,
man.
All the Victor Garber stuff, which is so like ham-fisted.
Oh, he's great.
You know, he, as the designer of the Titanic, like all the stuff, like, I told them not to go fast, but they want us to go fast. Like all that stuff, you know, the captain going down with his ship, is so heartbreaking. It's amazing that something that is so huge, that the movie is just so big and the screenplay is just so long. I'm not sure there's like a wasted line in it. Like, not that all the lines are great, but, you know, like every single thing like adds up to like that little bit of character stuff so that you know who these people are, when they live or when they don't live. And it's really remarkable.
The other thing that got me at the end was, like you were talking about with the sound design, all the noise and everything. And when the ship finally goes underwater and it's just gone all of a sudden. And he has that big wide shot of everyone screaming and flailing in the water. And it really hits home, like, how many people died an awful, awful death.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not, and it doesn't first, I don't, I'm actually, I'm really shocked about this. It doesn't feel exploitative. Like,
no.
Because, you know, through his weird little manipulative, like, okay, let's make the Irish guy. And what's an Irish guy? An Irish guy is fun loving and likes to drink. Okay. But I got that guy in my head. But like, you know, but those, you know, those like, you know, mythic level stereotypes, like, you know, there's an Irish guy going down that, you know what I mean? Like there's something like it really has, he's really, you know, managed to cement, you know, the types of people and the, and you can picture the dreams that they have that are going down with the ship.
Yeah.
It's really something. And then there, the other thing that like I'm just thinking about now is that there is a lot of, you know, kind of classic Fatal Attraction, or zombie movie stuff where like, oh shoot, the monster's not dead, you know? Like there are times in which like the chase continues when, you know, by all accounts, it probably shouldn't, but it never quite feels like that, you know?
Yeah.
It, like, you know, Lovejoy is a ridiculous character when it all comes down to it. Like he is singularly focused on being a toady for the world, the worst human being.
Yeah.
Zane. but at the same time, like, you know, we moviegoers, we know that that guy is going to stop at nothing. And he doesn't.
Yeah.
He just like keeps going. He's never going to give these guys a break. And, it's amazing that they're able to like pull off the like pleasures of that. The like almost like, you know, the thriller horror movie, you know, straw dogs, like pleasures of like that kind of chase and that kind of like relentless danger. It's amazing that he's able to weave that through this like monumental danger that's happening right then.
Totally. All right, Nate, that was great.
Titanic,
we like to close with a couple of segments here on Movie Crush. What Ebert said, the great Roger Ebert gave Titanic 4 stars.
Was he a 4-star remover or a 4-star reviewer or a 5-star reviewer?
He was 4. This got max. Yeah.
Good for Roger.
So he said this,
he
movies like this are not merely difficult to make at all, but almost impossible to make well. The technical difficulties are so daunting that it's a wonder when the filmmakers are also able to bring the drama and history into proportion. I found myself convinced by both the story and the saga. The setup of the love story is fairly routine, but the payoff, how everyone behaves as the ship is sinking, is wonderfully written as passengers are forced to make impossible choices.
Yeah, man. I feel like he nailed it. And I would also, let's talk about one of the Oscar winners from this movie. Let's talk about, My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion.
All right. Let's
talk
about
it. One hand, okay, not a good song. Like, don't get me wrong. Like when it's on, I cringe a little bit. But melodically strong for sure. It has a key change that it's totally unnecessary. but it is as it is that song and it's 3.5 minutes. Like, can you think of, I'm not sure I can think of a song that is better matched to its movie. Because it is absurdly huge. You know, like it's like that key change where everything just lifts up for like one more octave is that moment when, oh my God, the Titanic still has to sink. That is that key change. It's like, oh my God, how much bigger this can this be? And Celine's like, let me show you. But beyond that, that like, but also like it's, you know, it's message. The idea that like, it really does, it embodies the thing. Like My Heart Will Go On is the idea that like, here, this person that I have like, you know, fallen deeply in love with, who knows where our lives are going to go. But like, no matter how far, like what you have given me will like live on. And the other thing is my heart will go on. Like I will survive this thing. And fundamentally, you know, as much as anything, like what is the most sort of powerful, like enduring thought of Titanic? It's that like, basically, you know, there are times when like, shit is really crazy in your life and you will survive them and you will move on. You know, as we've seen, Rose goes on and she's a pilot and all sorts of crazy stuff. And then she's a nice old lady.
Nate, I love that you are clearly cruising into your 40s with a young daughter, exactly as you should.
Can't wait to shore Titanic.
All right, so we finished with five questions with Nate DeMeo. Number one, the first movie you remember seeing in the theater.
I believe that the first movie I remember seeing in the theater was actually Star Wars. That was another movie that was out for a really long time. I feel like it was probably on like month 16, and I was like four or something. And I don't think it was my first movie, but it's the first movie I remember seeing.
All right, that's a good one. First R-rated movie you saw, either in the theater or at home.
The first R-rated movie I saw, I think I was five. And this is going to make my parents seem like bad people. I think I was five, and I saw it in the theater, and it was Alien.
Oh. That makes your parents seem like awesome people.
Well, except that, like, come on. No, literally, like, the idea of me, like, there was no way in hell I would ever take my daughter to see Alien at five. But the thing was, they were talking about it a lot. They were really excited about it. They loved Alien. And my brother was a little bit older, and he could have handled it, but there was sort of, like, no way I was going to let him go without me.
Yeah.
And so what my dad did is he got the comic book novelization of Alien.
Ah.
And so I read it over and over and over again.
Before
and
the movie.
So by the time I saw Alien, as scary as it was, I feel like I can handle it. And I don't remember like being haunted by it. I don't remember having nightmares. But I do think there was some like residual thing. Cause like I hate horror movies now. Like I like fundamentally kind of can't handle them. So there wasn't like there was not like something where like it did not like, I think the fact that it did not like create some love of like the thrills and horror in me, even though I love that movie.
Yeah.
I feel like I was too young. So remember that as your daughter gets to be five, no Alien.
Number three, do you walk out of a bad movie and do you remember doing so?
I don't. I did it once though. And it's not even that bad of a movie, but I was on a date in high school. We went to go see the movie Sneakers with Robert Redford, which actually some people love. But we both really hated it, but I think we just wanted to go somewhere and make out.
Right. There you go. That's a great reason. Cause you know, if Sneakers doesn't make you want to go make out, then no movie will.
Oh, totally. Absolutely.
Such a sexy
Robert
movie.
Robert Redford is super handsome.
Number four, do you have a guilty pleasure movie that you return to time and again?
I'm definitely, I don't believe in guilty pleasures, but that said, a movie that I really, really love that I totally stand for that no one seems to the degree to I do, because I truly, truly love it and I will watch it anytime it's on, is Dave with Kevin Klein.
Right.
Where he's the
that
president.
That was a good movie.
I freaking love that movie. Oh, yeah. God, I love that movie.
All right.
I could have picked Dave.
And then finally, number five, movie going 101. What is your movie ritual like at the theater?
We live near the ArcLight, which is, you know, one of your finer movie theaters. So it's, you know, it's got the seating that, you know, you choose, which I love, which is like the world's greatest innovation.
It sure is.
You know your seat and you can get there 4 minutes before and it's fine. But I like, I like small popcorn. I like a Diet Coke. I like to sit like row five and in the middle.
Okay.
I like to, because I really like to be as sort of immersed as I can. Like in a perfect world, I would be sitting there and there would not quite be anyone around me. I either want to be like the movie theater to be completely packed, or to be sort of empty. I also do a lot of I go to movies by myself a lot.
Yeah.
And which is just one of like the world's great joys.
It sure is. Awesome, Nate DeMeo. Thanks for doing this, my friend.
Oh, Chuck, super fun.
Wow. Well, that was a lot of fun. Nate's the best. I love that guy. The Titanic, his take on it, I think gave me new insights for sure. It was kind of cool to hear someone who an admitted sort of hipster taste, deep underground music and movie guy, independent film guy, kind of go on the record with such a sort of a sugary blockbuster epic movie like this. So it was a very much a surprising choice when Nate said he wanted to talk about Titanic. But I think he made quite a case for it and pointed out a lot of things to me that I had never noticed before. And it was just a good conversation. Nate's a great guy. So remember to check out The Memory Palace, his awesome podcast. It's really good. It'll be worth your time for sure. And I will see you next time on Movie Crush. And until then, maybe you should take some Kleenex into the theater, because I have a feeling you're going to cry.